And there are these two pieces are drafted separately just because they approach it slightly differently, and they will end up going to different committees. But they're part of the same concept, and there's also two other bills that are related to tax benefits to try to attract green businesses to Minnesota. So those will be flowing through to the tax committee later. So let me start by explaining 3539 and 3540. Both use similar language. And if you look at Senate File 3540, this one I think really lays it out on the second page. It lists the five major policy bills that have been passed in Minnesota in recent years that set a high standard for renewable energy, for clean energy in Minnesota, and for the green, what we're calling the green economy. They set a high standard of state policy. That includes the renewable energy standard passed last year, the energy conservation standard of requiring reductions of 1.5% a year in energy usage for energy efficiency. And the third one is the greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals, which were passed in Senator Prentner Solon's Next Generation Energy Act last year. And that bill calls for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by 15% by 2015 and other incremental steps to get to 80% reduction by 2050. Then number four is the Clean Water Legacy Act, and number five is our 25 by 25 biofuels goal that's established in Minnesota law. So if you take those five policies, you see that Minnesota has set high standards, and what we want to do is align those environmental and green economy goals with our economic development policies. That's what these bills do. So if you look at, Senate File 3539 talks about existing economic development programs that we have under the jurisdiction of DEED. And I will go through quickly and say which ones it applies to. The Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program, the Greater Minnesota Redevelopment Accounts, the Minnesota Investment Fund. It's supposed to apply to all the redevelopment fund accounts. So maybe I read that wrong. So essentially, this is intended to say that for the existing economic development programs that we have, the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Redevelopment Fund accounts that are used to inspire redevelopment and development across the state and to attract businesses to different communities in our state, we want a factor that the commissioner looks at in granting those dollars to be the factor that it would enhance or improve our green economy goals in the state of Minnesota. So it's a way, again, to try to tie the goals that we pass together with our economic development programs without putting any new money into these programs, because I know that that may not be possible this legislative session. And the beginning of the bill, 3539, says the commissioner overall shall give priority to grant applications for projects that advance or promote the green economy as defined by that list of bills. And so what this would do in reality is to say if someone comes to Minnesota and they want to build wind turbines or they want to build solar panels or they want to set up shop insulating homes, putting new windows in, if they want to expand their existing window business, then we're going to say that that fits in with our policy goals in Minnesota, and we're going to look at we're going to give you some priority or at least some consideration in granting economic development dollars. And then the second bill, 3540, creates a task force, a green economy transformation task force, to try to get us to the next level in this process of promoting green jobs in Minnesota. And so this would set up a task force that would work together with the state agencies and commission some key studies that we need to do to figure out what economic development steps need to be taken in Minnesota to create and attract those green jobs here to our state. First, if you look on Senate File 3540, page 2, the three studies on the bottom of the page are a market analysis of business opportunities and needs created by those laws that I listed. an analysis of the labor force needs related to those meeting the market for those. So in other words, the analysis that needs to be done is, you know, how many wind turbines are we going to need in our state to meet our renewable energy mandate? How much biofuels development and what products does that entail in Minnesota to meet the goals that we've already set by law? And then we need to look at what workforce would be needed and job training would be needed to get the workforce to do those jobs. And so that's the third piece, is an inventory of the current labor and business assets available. So look at what we have in the way of the manufacturing base, the industrial base to meet those goals, what labor and workforce assets we already have, and then give us information about what more we need to do to be able to meet those policy goals we've already set in terms of the job creation that will come out of it. So I hope that's a clear explanation.
Back here.
We have this handout that I think all of you should have received. That this is just one study that has been done that's talked about the job creation potential from renewable energy manufacturing. And this shows that Minnesota has the opportunity to expand with over 18,000 new green jobs. And think about where we're at in our economy right now, because we all know that job growth is at its lowest, most sluggish level we've had in decades. And in Minnesota in particular, we're really hurting in the area of job growth. We asked the Department of Employment and Economic Development how many manufacturing jobs were lost in Minnesota in the 6 years from 2000 to 2006, and the answer is 50,000 jobs lost in Minnesota during that time period. And so if we have the potential to attract and create thousands of new jobs to our state to meet the mandates that we've already set into law, we need to get started and do it intentionally and not just sort of wait for it to accidentally happen. Let me just tell you one quick story about Iowa. We've heard in Iowa they've been incredibly successful at attracting wind turbine manufacturers. And we're lucky we have one here in Minnesota, Suslan, and that's been great. But Iowa has been aggressively marketing their state in Europe, and they've managed to attract at least three major European wind turbine manufacturers to come to their state. I had a conversation with the Speaker of the House in Iowa, very nice guy, and he said, hey, we don't need to pass a mandate in Iowa. We just tell these manufacturers, come to our state and look over there in Minnesota. They passed this mandate. They have a guaranteed market for wind turbines, so we can sell them there. And so they're using our laws to bring jobs to their state, and that's not right. I mean, more power to Iowa, but we need those jobs right here in our state. And we've got the market. So this is all about trying to establish and develop and enhance those markets in our state. I've got a couple people with me who can speak to this eloquently. Lynn Hinkle on my right, a former member of the UAW and officer. You can tell us on your history and at the Ford plant, and Brad Leto, who we all know from AFL-CIO.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Metzen, Chair, members of the committee. I really appreciate having the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate File 3539 and Senate File 3540.
Your name? State
name
your name.
Is Lynn Hinkle. I'm a union guy, like Senator Anderson indicated. Worked for 30 years at the Ford plant in St. Paul, 20 of those as a union official. I'm currently working on the development team of the Mayor's Green Manufacturing Initiative, and I'm a convener of a coalition of environmental, housing, transit, and labor organizations to convert the Ford site into a green manufacturing mixed use. I'll be brief. Both Senate File 3539 and Senate File 3540 are much needed if Minnesota intends to develop the capacity for green jobs. Based on the legislation that Senator Anderson spoke of for renewable energy production, energy conservation, greenhouse gas mitigation, and biofuels. Developing this capacity is critical for securing a significant place in the green jobs market. Ford's closure, which is pretty spectacular in some respects, helps to focus on the state's loss of manufacturing jobs, which we just heard about, which number 50,000 between 2000 and 2006. In some respects, the closure of the Ford facility is a blessing in that it helps to illustrate in one fell swoop, in a dramatic moment, really a problem that this state has been facing. We've been dying a death of 1,000 cuts. Manufacturing facilities all over the state have been closed. The Ford facility is a spectacular example, and it really helps us to focus on that situation. But it's not all bad news. As these two bills point, we have an opportunity, and we need to grab that opportunity with this kind of legislation. Many parts of the new energy economy will potentially provide significant family-sustaining jobs. And let me mention just a couple. Senator Anderson has directed your attention to some of the figures that were developed by the Renewable Energy Policy Program, REP, which talks about the creation of 18,000, really more than 18,000, manufacturing jobs. Now, we're not talking about a multiplier effect here. We're not talking about all the jobs that are created when you locate a manufacturing facilities with tax base and high-paid jobs that come from that. We're talking about just the core, the productive capacity, manufacturing jobs. And that's 18,000 jobs over a 10-year period that would come from the potential for producing renewable energy equipment in this state. Let's look at the energy efficiency component of last year's landmark legislation. It's estimated by the Apollo Alliance, another blue-green, green jobs advocacy organization, that for every 100 large buildings that you do energy efficiency retrofits to, you create 2,000 jobs. It doesn't take anybody a lot of really complicated math in this room to figure out how many thousands of good family-sustaining jobs could be created. And not just doing the energy efficiency retrofits, because what I like to remind people all the time is, who's going to build those new high-performance HVAC systems that we're going to install when we do energy efficiency retrofits? Who's going to build the biofuel generators that are going to be mandated by our biofuel legislation? Just like we've become clear, there's an opportunity for us to manufacture wind turbines. Let me conclude by making a couple of final statements. But none of this, as Senator Anderson indicated, is automatic. And you hear this from time to time that, well, we just created the demand and people are going to show up. Capital is going to flow into the state. Well, what these two pieces of legislation do is make the necessary steps to increase our capacity. Because, in fact, none of that demand production automatically creates jobs. And these two bills combine to focus deeds capacity on the green jobs engine in this new emerging green economy. While the task force transformation piece, and I really like that because it really is that, it's transformation, not just transition, not doing more a little bit at a time. It's a transformation task force, helps the state financially and organizationally to complement those activities in 35-39. And one final statement. How many of you have watched the ads coming out of Michigan that are touting Michigan as a new source of high-tech jobs and high-tech facilities? Probably most of you, like myself. What I find interesting is that there is no state, most notably a state like Michigan, and God knows I got a lot of knowledge about assembly plants in Michigan, that is talking about taking the lead, raising the flag, sending a steady, constant signal that we want to carve out green manufacturing. No state has taken that position. No state has clearly branded itself. No state has consistently sent that signal. These two pieces of legislation will help us to consistently send that signal and make it clear to investors around this country and worldwide that Minnesota is ready to take the lead in green manufacturing.
Isn't that one of my good lines? Taken out of money already.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Leto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brad Leto, Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. I'll be fairly brief, especially because Mr. Hinkle was very eloquent and in his statements. We do support Senate File 3539 and Senate File 3540. The time is, I think that Senator Anderson had mentioned that we can't wait and have it accidentally happen to us with the jobs that are going to be created in the future around the environment and the green economy. And I think, and I know Ms. Trinkle said no state has really, has branded itself as a green manufacturing state. Unfortunately, I think a couple of them are getting closer, and I think we have to be at the forefront of that because the jobs are going to be created. Jobs of the future are going to be created, and we'd certainly like to see them created here. Which is why we're involved. And a lot of folks look at us, aren't you worried about? Worried about the jobs that are going to go and keeping those. Fact of the matter is, as we've seen, 50,000 manufacturing jobs leave, and I actually think that might be a little low, but I'll go with the official statistics. I think unless we start looking at that and dealing with this now, and being involved in the process. The process is just going to roll over us otherwise. We'd want to be at the one of the main states to take a lead on this, I think, because as I say, it's going to happen, and I don't think we can afford any more job loss in the state, especially with working to the future at good paying jobs, and that's what we're about, and that's why we're supporting this. So I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Somebody mentioned Iowa. What kind of incentives do they have that we don't?
Well, Mr. Chair,
other than probably paying their people less, I'm not sure of that. But
yeah, I don't know what the finances are exactly. I do know that they've had an extremely aggressive marketing campaign, and they've had people work full-time in Europe sitting at the doorstep of the manufacturing companies, and that their governor has gone to trade shows and personally met with manufacturers. And so they've just, made a very aggressive effort to attract them. In the last few years, all of the major wind turbine manufacturers in Europe, well, most of them have started just in the last 5 years or so to establish a presence in the United States. Because we have a shortage of turbines, we have a huge demand for them. It's a growing market, and they're big, expensive things to move around. So they're coming here, and the question is, are we going to let other states beat us out, or are we going to be in the lead to try to attract them? So I think that's part of this is a little bit of a friendly competition among the states, friendly
Senator,
or not so friendly. Yeah.
Ed, is that something that the task force might recommend how we could be more aggressive, or
yes,
whether financially or
yes,
some ways, tax credits, or that been there somewhere?
Specifically talks about a marketing strategy, or we're going to be doing that. We've talked with, I'm trying to remember the exact language here.
What is D? Have they been doing anything so far on their own on this stuff? Or?
They have a staff person who's been working on it, and we had a green manufacturing task force in the Twin Cities that the mayor's commissioned, and the DEED representative was part of that, and they've compiled information about all the different parts of the manufacturing base that exist for supporting wind turbine manufacturing, because it takes lots of different parts to make it happen. And we have almost all of that in place in Minnesota of what it would take to support a major manufacturer.
We just don't want to, the way I understand it, we just don't want to assemble the parts. We want to build the parts.
That would be nice.
Not just put pieces together is what I've been hearing all along. And Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Anderson is exactly right. I think Iowa has done a very good job, and other states has done a very good job at marketing and putting themselves out there in position for these emerging technologies and businesses. I also note in Iowa, because I only live about 8 miles from there, that they are able to compete one-on-one with programs such as JobZ. Without having a JobZ program in place, they can match all those incentives right there. And their permitting processes are much more, I shouldn't say easier, but a little more accommodating and business-friendly, working with like the Pollution Control Agency and various other permitting agencies. So they've created an environment to attract these businesses, and they market it, and they stand behind it. So it is a competitive arena.
Well, so that's what Senator Anderson and Senator Rosen, what kind of the guts of this thing is, Section 1, this task force to come up with these suggestions and ideas. And
yes, Mr. Chair, and we've already talked to Commerce, the Department of Commerce, who had some money to support the Green Manufacturing Task Force, and they're going to go to the next level and do the marketing, create a marketing plan or an analysis of how we can do better in Minnesota. And I agree with you, Senator Rosen. I'm actually, one of my other bills is looking at JobZ type benefits for green manufacturing opportunities. So I'd really like to talk with you about that.
Senator Rosen.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I believe the green manufacturing would be in the preview of JobZ. I do believe that would fall right into it because it is manufacturing. So we should talk.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, what, since I'm chair of the Economic Development Committee, I'm wondering exactly what shall give priority means. And the reason I'm asking that is because there may be a lot of grants for the commissioner to consider that might not fit the definitions of green economy or green technology. And does that mean that then the commissioner can't consider those, or can only consider the green applications? I mean, for example, say Intel were to want to come to northern Minnesota because they need a real lot of water to do their computer chips, and they've got a 400 or 500 job plant that they want to put in there, and a 50 job manufacturing windmill plant comes in. Does the commissioner then have to give the money to the windmill, or can he still consider the Intel, or what does shall give priority mean?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
Senator Tomasoni, that's a really good question, which I thought you might ask, and we can work on making sure we have a consensus on what we mean. But what I was thinking is, I originally proposed saying that any application that related to green manufacturing should just get, bumped ahead of everyone else in line, but that's not what it says here in terms of the individual programs. It's one factor that needs to be considered. And then the direction to the commissioner overall is to give priority to these projects. But, there's other really worthy projects that we don't want to have them go away. We just want this to be a priority for the department. So trying to walk that fine line is where I'm trying to go. So if we need to, make sure the language works to do that,
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think we do need to figure out what it means or how to change the language in such a way that we don't tell other people we don't want you in the state unless you're green, because shall give priority to me does indicate that maybe we don't want other people here, and I would hope that that's not what we're trying to do here, because there's a lot of worthy manufacturing plants that may not be green, but we would love to have the jobs.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I don't want to shut anybody out who's going to bring good jobs to our state. I'm totally with you there. I just want to say that this is a priority for our state. We want to move forward in this direction, and we want to put a lot of effort into it. So, maybe we need to restate that just a little bit to be clear about that. And I'm totally open to that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it's not quite the same meaning, but what if we said the commissioner shall encourage grant applications or something to that effect? I think Senator Tomasoni makes a good point about, I mean, I understand what Senator Anderson wants to do, and I wholeheartedly support it. I just also don't want to see us not have. So I just thought shall encourage, but I'm not really offering it as an amendment if you like that. Or
I think we can figure this out. Senator Tomasoni and Council Fuller, I believe, are looking at what you're trying to accomplish, Senator Scheid. Senator Tomasoni.
Well, Senator Anderson, I think this works to get to where we want to go.
Senator Anderson.
Because we're talking about rural technologies, and I think maybe Mr. Fuller, you can help me explain this, because it looks to me like your report tells the commissioner to optimize the growth of the green economy, and if we were to just delete that first section, he would still be doing what you want him to do, without sending a real bad signal to other companies that might want to come here that if you're not green, we don't want you. Section 5 gets to where you want to go as far as optimizing green technology for the commissioner's purposes are concerned. And I don't know how we, Mr. Fuller, do you have a suggestion on how we get as far as what would be an amendment that would keep the spirit of what Senator Anderson wants to do, but to also take care of my concern?
Mr. Chair, I think the suggestion is to delete Section 1, and I think that's okay. I honestly do, because we're going to perhaps that analysis should occur first before we get into that much detail about what the commissioner should do with specific programs. And we're also going to have this transformation task force that will come back with a lot of recommendations that will help us decide specific steps that should be taken. And I don't want to create ambiguity that, you know, we're for all good jobs, you know. So I think if you require the commissioner to analyze them all and have a plan to optimize the growth of the green economy, I'd be comfortable with that. That's in Section 5.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, does Section 3 and Section 4 do exactly the same thing as Section 1 by adding those the project
no.
Promotes?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to have those in there because those just there's a long list of factors that have to be looked at, and this creates one of them that should be that's on the list. It creates a factor that's on the list. It doesn't say that this supersedes all other factors. It just says when this is, I think, a good first step, that when they're looking at grant applications, they need to consider whether it will advance the green economy and help us achieve those state goals. But that doesn't have to mean, you know, just like it, they have to look at.
We want that in there.
Mr. Chairman.
I mean, for example, I'm sorry. Well, Mr. Chair, I was just looking at.
Just on Section 3, though.
Some of these are mutually exclusive. They're not all. No project has to meet all of these criteria is what I'm trying to say.
Section 3 talks about, like Senator Tomasoni's going down that road. Must prioritize, right?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I think it strikes me that Section 4 actually does require it because it's and. And it is current in current law, it's and. What is an eligible project? But it says, and the project promotes or advances. So I don't know that you. It means it has to do all of those seven things ahead of it, but it also has to do number eight.
Yeah,
and I think you want to do that exactly that way.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I'm just
Anderson.
Looking at that same section, and if you look at 6 and 7, those are the two that I was going to say look like those aren't really consistent with each other. Whether assistance is necessary to retain existing business, And number seven, whether assistance is necessary to attract out-of-state business. So I don't think it can meet both of those. That was where I was coming from in saying that I don't think it has to meet every single one of these criteria. But maybe it's just the way that it's drafted.
Chairman, can I get an opinion from Mr. Fuller on sections 3 and 4? Just out of curiosity, what do you think they say?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I think Section 1 was an absolute priority. As Senator Anderson said, Section 3 makes it one of the factors you consider when you're determining priority projects. So it doesn't exclude other projects just because it would be a factor that if the commissioner, I assume everything else was equal, then this would tip the balance. But there's a lot of other things that go into the equation. So it's a little different than Section 1. Section 4, if you look at lines 3.28 to 3.0, it does say, referring up to those numbered clauses, a grant or loan cannot be made based solely on a finding that the condition in clauses 6 or 7 exists. A finding must be made that condition in clause 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 also exists. So 8 won't do it alone there.
Okay.
So they're different in degree and not in kind. I mean, they give priorities, but in a different fashion.
So, Mr. Chairman, then it's okay with you. I move to delete Section 1.
I can live with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't you want to also put on line 329, wouldn't you then want to say clause parens 6, comma, parens 7, or parens 8? Wouldn't you want to do that?
Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, that's a policy decision. I mean, 6 and 7 on line 29, they cannot be the sole basis. So you wouldn't want to add them. So the question becomes whether or not a finding simply that condition 8 exists is what the committee wants to do, or leave that out of, you know, that you can't just find 8, you'd have to find the others. So this makes it, you see what I'm saying? Because it says a finding must be made that condition in clause 1, 2, 3, or 5 also exists. So that means that it just couldn't be 8, as the bill now reads, in addition to 5 and 6, or 6 and 7, I'm sorry. It's a little complicated, but, I mean, it's when you parse through it, that's what it means. You just can't, 6 and 7 won't support a priority. You have to have one of the other ones. So the issue before the committee is, do we add 8 in there as one that can support it by itself?
And Mr. Chairman,
and it doesn't as of now.
Ms. Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, well, I think that Senator Anderson wants it to, and I think. So is that – I'm not sure.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I could – I think if you leave it silent, it works because it already has to meet 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. And I think that's appropriate so that you're looking at high wage levels, leverage of private funds, increase in the tax base. I mean, I think those are appropriate things that should be considered in combination with advancing the green economy. So I think if you're silent, I think that creates a little bit of balance, but still gives it some priority.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Fuller, if all 7 clauses are mentioned between 328 and 330, shouldn't clause 8 have to be mentioned also?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, not necessarily. Senator Anderson just explained that she doesn't want that to be the only basis of supporting a grant. She wants one of the other 5 conditions also to exist and thinks that's the fair approach at this time, is my understanding. So you'd...
Okay.
Okay, is that understood? Did we...
And I move to delete Section 1, Mr. Chairman.
On the Tomasoni amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Did we have a technical amendment to this?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment on 3539.
Okay. That puts down Job Skills Partnership Board instead of just the board. I guess that's who. Senator Anderson, are we deleting board and putting the Job Skills Partnership Board in instead? Is that the proper?
That's what Mr. Fuller suggested.
Okay.
Because it's got that local option stuff.
Okay. Okay. I think that's all right. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Anderson.
The Pollution Control Agency had asked to be added to the Transformation Task Force, but we could save that for this. Has to go to that bill has to go to Senator Rest Committee, so where they'll talk about the task force.
Oh, she
so
did.
Just wanted to mention that.
We're going to back up. Senator Escoy moves the A1 amendment. I think I had you doing it, but you're not on the committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Now, Senator Anderson, what's
chair of this committee?
What were you?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say for the record, I had been asked by the Pollution Control Agency to be added to the Green Transformation Task Force, and I don't have any objection to that, but I thought maybe I would ask the committee, Senator Rest Committee, to do that because they're really more focused on, unless someone here really wants to do that, they're focused on the task force. So, and
right, that is under their jurisdiction, the task force and commissions and committees and so forth. So we could do that, but we'll pass her by here. But this is kind of an important process for DEED and how we're going forward in their department, and I'd like to at least get a few statements out of them, how they expect to accomplish this and how much more money they think they need and so forth and so on. Could we hear from DEED what your thoughts are on this? And before that, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, and it is concerning the task force. And the last transformation task force I was on was health care, which we were mandated last year to work on that, and it was the governor's appointment of the task force. And if you look at, Senator Anderson, the breakdown of this task force, it's very much on the side of the legislative body, and the governor only gets to appoint one from the Office of Energy Security, one from the Department of DEED, one from Job Skill Partnership, one from the University of Minnesota, and one from MinSCU, and one additional member. So you've got six for the governor, and you've got then you've got this private sector that the legislative body gets to appoint. So I was hoping there could be more of a balance between the governor and the legislative body on this task force. Because on page 2, line 3, it says the governor exempt from the requirements of the open appointments. And I think it would just bode well, and you might have a more fair and reasonable outcome.
Senator Anderson, have you given that any thought? I suppose you have.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm open to suggestions. It's
minority member, minority party gets one appointment.
It's this say. Is an idea that came from legislators, and I think that's why it ended up this way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly intended to be bipartisan. So
I see you've got that, Senator. You've got the bipartisan language in there in the legislators,
mm-hmm.
which is good. It should be.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering,
go ahead.
With the private sectors, the six persons, if we could maybe do something with that as far as the governor's office and his appointments.
Would the body be willing to let, normally we try to do our work in this committee, but these are the last two issues are our GovOp issues or address.
Yeah.
I'm willing to, as one member, let Senator Rosen work on that, make up with you, Senator Anderson. And what was the one before that?
The other one was about the PCA being the
Yeah, PCA. And I think you can we can work on those two issues as far as I'm concerned as you go to the next committee.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. I can work with Senator Rosen, and we can see if we can.
Senator Rosen, is that all right to work?
Come up with some changes.
Thank you.
Yeah, we want to keep it objective and well-balanced. I mean, that's the idea of the whole thing, I believe, and really believe that. But let's hear from Dee just for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and how they're going to help us legislature and the state to go forward with this this thinking. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Meredith Udoybach, and I'm with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. First of all, on these two bills, we're neutral. Currently, the programs that are listed in Senate File 3539, we do not have a priority for green energy in those bills. However, there's lots of things that we consider in ranking the projects that come in for those programs, and this would just be one additional area that we would look at in giving additional points for any programs or projects that are coming in through those programs. Senator Anderson is correct that we have a staff person currently that is working on renewable energy. He's helping to kind of put forth some of the mandates that have already been passed in previous years and coordinating with the community and the businesses to make sure that they're aware of those mandates and that they get accomplished. So the task force would be something that I would assume would piggyback on some of his efforts. Mr. Chair, you had asked about any fiscal impact that task force would have on the department. I see that there's an open appropriation. We have not yet done a fiscal note on that, but I would anticipate it would perhaps be a staff position, and we could certainly get back to you on the fiscal impact that would result in.
Was that? And I made this statement 100 times before. I'll try to make it one more time, we'll make it one more time. Every time we create a task force or another group, we have to add four people or two people or 2.5 people. So some of these departments have 1,800, 2,400 people, and maybe it's just me, but I think, well, do it. I mean, just do it. That's my first reaction today, but I'm usually right, but.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, and that's something we possibly could do as well. I know.
I just don't think. Every time a department comes in here and we add a little job to do, we've always got to add money. I mean, well, that's why I'm so fiscally conservative.
Mr. Chair and members,
I see the department took a courageous stand on this one, though. You're neutral, so that's very good. Senator Lance, what do you got on your mind? Anything today? You were busy all morning.
Lots of things today, but right. Nothing before the committee at the moment.
Okay, good.
And, Mr. Chair, I can certainly work with Senator Tomasoni's division on if there's money needed for market analysis, that's the only piece that might take a contract or something. So we can talk about that and
I think
make that happen.
Seems like everybody in the world wants this bill, don't they? There are these bills, energy and Senator
so popular.
Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point for Senator Anderson, and maybe this language is trying to get to some of the potential fiscal impacts, but I'm looking at lines 2.6 and 2.7. The task force may accept outside resources to help support its efforts. Are you talking about outside expertise, or you're actually talking about outside dollars? What were you? So I'm on the second page, lines 2.6 and 2.7. Outside resources.
I can't find the language.
Ouch. It's in 3540.
Okay, 2.5 and 2.6, sorry.
2.6 and 2.7, really.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, I think we were looking to see if we thought there was an opportunity to find some funding sources, private funding matches, some partners. And I don't know yet, but we had discussion about this quite a while ago, and I'm trying to remember now exactly who. I don't know who, but I think there may be some possibilities. I mean, when we did the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul did a green manufacturing task force, and there was some state funding that enabled part of that, the work that was done. And the cities came up with some of the other funding. And so I think there hopefully will be ways to try to stretch the dollars that are needed as far as possible. Because obviously we just don't have a lot of money to spend right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, Senator Anderson, I don't see it in here, but I heard it was in here. Does this eliminate the Electric Energy Task Force?
No, Mr. Chair. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
There is another bill like that. Is there one?
There's another bill that does that?
Is there another bill like that floating around? Yes.
Not that I'm aware of.
I view this. I thought of it myself, but this is a different kind of a deal. A big, you know, it's different.
Yeah,
and
Mr. Chair.
Than the duties of the task force, electric energy, I think. So, that's another day, probably. Who goes go to energy first, then?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe both of these are scheduled for the energy policy.
I think they're already scheduled tomorrow.
Close, so.
Senator Carlson, are you listening here? Would you like to make a motion to take one at a time, I suppose? Senate File 3539. Recommend it to pass and forward it to the Energy Committee. Is that your motion?
Sure, that's my motion.
On the motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Second motion. Senator Sparks will move Senate File 3540. Are any of these amended? So we did amend. The first one that Senator Carlson moved was as amended. The next one is Senate File 3540. Senator Sparks moves that. Adoption of that. Recommends it to pass and forward it to the Energy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Bach is a. First of all, one of the bills is his, and the other one I know he's very concerned about, as we all are, but I know he's got some, I think, an amendment or two. So I suppose we could start discussion on the bill. We've got the bill before us will be Senate File 2818, another Senator Anderson's bill, Green Solutions Act of 2008, cap and trade program for greenhouse gas emissions. It would be all right. I think we could start the discussion. We've got some witnesses, Pulaski, Senator Garvey, or not Senator Garvey, Ed Garvey. Diana, is that a promotion or a demotion?
Definitely
Diane
demotion.
Schmidt and Michael Robertson. So maybe Senator Anderson, you may proceed.
Okay, I wonder. So, Mr. Chair, you would like me to start?
Please, okay. Senator Anderson, Senate File 2818.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we're just getting copies of Third and Grossman of Senate File 2818.
Yes.
Does everyone have that? Okay, great.
It's also second
copy's kind of funny here.
Hey.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, let me just explain that this is a cap-and-trade bill that doesn't actually establish a cap-and-trade for Minnesota. What it does is several things. One is recognizes that the governor, Governor Pawlenty, has signed an agreement with, is it five or six other states?
Five other states.
Five other states and the province of Manitoba to create a regional Midwestern greenhouse gas reduction cap-and-trade plan. And so that process is moving forward, and the governors of these states will be negotiating a model rule to reach, to establish a regional Midwestern cap-and-trade program. That process is underway. The agreement was signed last fall, and the next step of their process is to establish a model rule and negotiate that by November of 2008. So the legislature will not be directly involved in negotiating that agreement. However, I thought it was important that the legislature have somewhat of a voice in this process as it moves forward. And so what we've done is establish some principles that I think would be good to see in a regional cap and trade program that establish fairness and integrity of a cap so that once you have a cap in place, you don't create giant loopholes that will allow it to be exceeded. And so these are that's the first and second, the second section of the bill is essentially a statement of principles. The third section of the bill talks about the process and says that the governor and his representatives shall report back to the legislature after they negotiate this model rule over the next year about what they've done and how it would how it aligns with the principles that we've talked about, and any suggestions for legislation. And then we create a legislative, it's not a team anymore, a legislative advisory group, which is consists of six members, bipartisan group of legislators that would be appointed to kind of track the governor's process, governor's plural process. So the governors from these six states will be negotiating, or their staff will be negotiating over the next, what's this, March, the next 5 months. And we just want some legislators to be able to be appointed so that they can have an opportunity to attend some of those meetings, perhaps, as time permits, and give any advice they can to the negotiators and receive information about what's happening. You know, we don't have the ability to say, Governor, we want to negotiate this. This is something that can only be done at the level of the governor. But it's important for the legislators to have a presence and a voice and an ability to be informed about what's happening and to offer advice. So that's the intention of the legislative advisory group. And finally, the end of Section 3 is one sentence that's very important, 3.12 and 3.13, and that says that any cap-and-trade agreement entered into, and that means by the governor, is not affected in Minnesota until enacted into law. And so essentially what we're doing is setting the stage for the next steps that will occur. The governors are negotiating this cap-and-trade. They will have an agreement, presumably, and they will bring that back to each state. And we just want to make clear that something as major and significant as a cap-and-trade program should not be adopted just by executive order, that it needs to be debated and established by law in Minnesota ultimately before it takes effect. And so that's what that sentence does. And then the last section of the bill is a number of studies, and the studies got longer and longer as we went through this negotiation process. And any item, you know, the items that were in dispute ended up basically being something that we would study, because there's a lot of question about what the costs and benefits of a regional cap and trade program would be to our economy, to our businesses, to our consumers, and what the benefits and to the environment and to the health of our people will be as well. And so it was, this bill has changed dramatically several times. It's gone through three committees already. And between the Environment Committee and the Energy Committee, Senator Pretner Solon helped us organize a stakeholder meeting. And we had some stakeholder discussion that was quite detailed before the bill went to the Energy Committee, before it went to Senator Pretner Solon's committee. And during that process, I made some major changes and concessions to this bill that, among other things, took away the requirement that 100% of the permits to emit carbon dioxide would be auctioned. We took that out of the bill. And some of the other changes that were made show up in the principles. And we also incorporated a lot of concerns from different stakeholders into what the study would consist of. So this is the product of a great deal of compromise. I want to say that to the members. Let's see, where do I begin?
Madam Chair.
Do you want to testify? Excuse me, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might ask Senator Anderson, could you, I think I understand the cap piece, but I'm not familiar with, or don't exactly understand how the trading part, the people who are trading are the businesses or the entities that have the caps in place, and if you could explain, what they're trading,
okay,
that would help me.
And I can try to say just a little bit in plain English, maybe, and I'll try, but we have some experts here who could maybe answer that better than I can. Dr. Steve Pulaski from the University of Minnesota, an economist, and J. Drake Hamilton from Fresh Energy. Essentially, with a regional cap, you'd have a overall limit on how much greenhouse gas could be emitted in the whatever the region is, and large emitters, which would include, the electricity sector, the transportation sector, the industrial sectors. We don't define. One of the other concessions we made was to not define who would be actually in the cap, but to leave that up to negotiation. Instead, to say as a principle that it should be as broad as possible. And that if you can verify how much you're emitting, it makes sense that you should be under the cap, if you can measure it and quantify it. And so pretty much the whole economy, ultimately, I think, should be in a cap in order to make it effective. And remember that in Minnesota, at least, a cap is based on goals that we already passed into law last year. That was the 15% reduction by 2015 and so on. So the idea of a cap is, here's what limits would have to be of global warming emissions to get us to those goals that we've already established by law. The trading piece, so anyone who does emit at a high level, the upstream level, so not each one of us, we don't each have to have a permit, but it would be at the higher level of each industrial sector or transportation sector or whatever that's distributing the sources of emissions around the state. They would have to buy a permit to, or be allocated a permit to emit those pollutants into the air. The whole concept is about putting a price on carbon, where now it's free. Now it's a free ride to emit global warming pollution into the atmosphere. There's no penalty, and it's time to put a price on it so that economic decisions will follow. Economic decisions will be based on the fact that it's more expensive to put global warming emissions into the air than it is to reduce them. And so the theory is that in some parts of the economy, it will be cheap and efficient to reduce your emissions. It'll be cheaper to do that than to have to get allowances. And for some parts of the economy, it'll be more expensive to reduce your emissions, so you'll want to buy allowances from someone else. That's the trading part. So the theory is it's market-based, and the market will drive the decision-making so that the sectors that are best able to reduce emissions can do that, save money, and sell the ability to pollute to others who need that more. Anything you want to add to that?
I understand that.
Okay.
Yes. Excuse me, Senator
Scoy. Madam Chair, if I may say one more thing, big debate is whether you give away for free the ability to emit this pollution or whether you charge for it, and that's called auctioning. So that's one of the issues under debate.
Okay. So question from Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, I understand that we're making this harder for industries that have a harder time meeting the cap. It kind of penalizes them, but that isn't my question. My question is, the Midwestern governors is 12 states, and you're talking about 6 states. Who's the governor negotiating with?
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, there's two different agreements that were made by Midwestern states. One is bigger, and one is the smaller group of 6 states. And the 6 states are the ones that agreed to a regional cap and trade. The broader group of states agreed to a broader agreement on moving towards renewable energy and renewable fuels and things like that. So, but the cap and trade was only agreed to by 6 states and Manitoba. And so that's what the governor will be negotiating.
And Madam Chair, are they listed in here what states they are? I was looking to see if I could find that.
Madam Chair, I can tell you they're Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, Kansas, and Wisconsin. So our neighbors, some are large industrial states and some are more rural states. So those governors have all committed to this process along with our governor. And I guess one of the messages I would really emphasize today is that I think the idea of a cap and trade is an idea where the train has left the station and is moving forward. And so my intention is not really to debate should we have a cap and trade, but to talk about how it should be done best and how it should be done best in a way that will help our economy and our people here in Minnesota and in the heartland of the United States. The governor signed an agreement. It's moving forward on the timeline that I mentioned. There's also clear consensus among the three major presidential candidates. All three of the major presidential candidates support a cap-and-trade program. And so the question is not if, but when and how it will be done. So I think what we need to really grapple with is what it will look like and how to make it fair and how to make it work most effectively and how, again, getting back to our last discussion, how to try to turn this to our advantage and see if we can benefit from the development of technologies that will be needed to meet these lower emissions goals. We're going to have to be very aggressive, everyone, whether it's in a region or a national program, and I think ultimately it will be national. It's just a matter of how long that will take. Everyone's going to have to figure out how to reduce emissions to the maximum extent possible, and that means that every effort that we can make to, for example, when it comes to homes, if we had a plan for our state to weatherize every home so we don't have leaky windows and leaky walls and inefficient old furnaces, like in my house, I'll be the first to volunteer, we will reduce emissions dramatically in our state, and we can put a lot of people to work doing that. So we have the opportunity to get the benefit from this if we are smart about it, and that's just a message I wanted to emphasize.
Excuse me, Senator Sequoia, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Anderson. Okay, so I've got the six states here, and I do notice that the Dakotas are absent from that, but you know, you talked about the three presidential candidates that are supportive of this and doing this the best and most efficiently. And wouldn't it be done best if it was done at a national level so we wouldn't have these regional differences where we're drawing lines between jurisdictions?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, I think in the end that is going to be the best solution. I agree with you. The bigger it is, I mean, ultimately it needs to be global. And making that happen, I'm not quite sure how we get there. But you don't want to have, you have holes, you have leaks, you have competition from sectors that aren't regulated at any level until it's completely global. But in the meantime, I don't think that's a reason for us to wait. And the reason I would say that is, number one, well, first of all, as I said, the governors have already, they're already moving forward. And so they're going to be designing it. And even if for some reason a new president is elected and they decide to move forward aggressively and quickly, if we have a plan, a design in place that we think works best for the Midwestern states and for Minnesota, I think we're in a better position when the national cap and trade is put together, because we've already established some rules and some principles, and we've researched what works, what we think will work and won't work. And if we're silent in our state, then I think in Washington they may just do whatever they want. Whereas if we have the more states that have worked together to create a plan, I think the more likely that we'll have some influence on a national debate. So I can't say for sure that Minnesota, that the region, the Midwest regional plan will go forward before a national plan, but I can tell you with certainty that the Midwest plan is going forward now. And I just think it's important for the legislature to be connected to that process and not just let the governors make those decisions without us. The governor has appointed a stakeholder group of four people to help him negotiate, three from industry and one environmentalist. So that's the group that will basically be representing Minnesota along with the governor's staff in these regional negotiations. And I think we need a little bit, they're good people, but I think we need a little bit broader input into this process.
Okay. So how about if we hear the testimony and perhaps I'll answer some of the questions and then provide opportunity for us to ask some more. So Dr. Pulaski, would you like to introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Steve Pulaski. I'm an economist at the University of Minnesota. I also served on the governor's I was on technical working groups for the Minnesota Climate Change Action Group, the Energy Supply Technical Working Group, and the Cap and Trade Technical Working Group. And I also came before the legislature to talk about cap and trade several times, actually, over the last couple of months. To start off with, actually, I'm going to be fairly brief because I'd rather leave time for questions, but just a couple of statements at the beginning, in particular in answer to the, sort of the first question that was raised. Sort of what is cap and trade? It actually is a very simple idea. The cap is the environmental part. You set the cap with the idea of what environmental goal do you want. In this case, we're talking about limiting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. So you establish a cap which puts an upper bound on how much of the greenhouse gas emissions will be allowed. And then the trade part is where you're allowing flexibility. You're basically, the way I like to say it, is harnessing market forces to achieve an environmental goal. So the idea here is that the regulated entities, those that would be emitting the greenhouse gases, they have allowances or permits to do so. At the end of the period, they have to have in hand the number of allowances or permits that are greater than or equal to how much they've emitted. Now, they can do this a couple of different ways. I mean, they can either cut their own emissions to get down to their allowances. They can go further, in which case they can sell off their extra permits allowances to others. Or they can buy them if they're short. Now, why do this? The cap part, again, is the environmental part. The trade part is really talking about the economic part of this, trying to meet the environmental goal in the least cost or most efficient manner. So there's been a movement in general in environmental policy towards incentive-based or market-based approaches. And again, the idea here is to try to be more flexible rather than just telling people exactly how they have to do it. Let the regulated entities have some freedom to figure out how best they can do it, that they're going to be able to do so in a cheaper manner. And that's really the idea behind the trade part of the cap and trade. I'd like to say a couple of words also just about various aspects of cap and trade. While the idea is very simple, the actual implementation of a cap and trade, you have to pay attention to the details. Then there are a number of very important details that can make this work very smoothly or not so smoothly. And so there were a number of principles in the bill that were put forward that are important to think about. So, for example, one that was highly contentious in the Climate Change Action Group was how do you give out the permits in the first place, or how is the allocation of allowances handled? And there are two main ways of doing this. One is by auction. In other words, you sell off the permits. And the other is basically to hand out the permits for free, typically called grandfathering, so that you know, give them to those who have emitted in the past. The original bill, as Senator Anderson said, was for 100% auction. There is disagreement in here. I will say, though, that economists favor auctions for a couple of reasons. One is that the idea here is that this is a valuable asset, the allowances, and it's like paying a price for any product. Most firms wouldn't give away a product for free. In this case, it's a valuable asset, you really want to, as Senator Anderson said, establish a price for these, and auctioning them off basically is one way of doing that right up front. Now, as I said, that was contentious. Other groups would like to have these handed out for free. And I will note that in a number of different cap and trade programs that exist, there has been in the past more of the what I'll call the grandfathering. The movement now is towards auctioning. So, for example, the Northeast states, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, has been moving steadily towards more auctioning of permits for the reasons that I indicated. The other couple of quickly a couple of other points on this, sort of the level at which, or the point of regulation that one considers, is very important. So one should not think about charging or having each household, for example, responsible for coming up with allowances to meet their greenhouse gas emissions. The idea here is to put this on a place where there are a few regulated entities. So in electric utilities, you'd put this on the load-bearing unit. In other words, the seller of electricity at the wholesale level, and have them be the ones to meet their target, to come in with a number of allowances to meet their emissions. The advantages of doing that are obvious in terms of administration, and again, one, you know, the details of this, try to make the cap and trade work as effectively and efficiently as possible. And I think with that,
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to the witness, probably, you were talking about doing this at the point of load, and we've talking about industries and sectors. Is the automobile industry brought into this somehow, and where's the point of load on our tailpipe emissions?
Dr. Plasky.
Yeah, so one thing that people typically talk about, for electricity, it's people have worked through those, and I think the point there is more obvious. That for automobiles and for gasoline emissions, I think the point of the equivalent that one would want to do there is to think about it at the refinery stage or the wholesale distributor of gasoline or diesel.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Doctor. So then, if you go to the refinery as the, and I don't know where else you would go, but how do they control what vehicles we buy, what, how far I drive? They're not in control of that. I don't want them to be in control of that. I don't want us to be in control of that. So how can you hold them accountable for the consumers?
So what the refinery basically would do is that they would have a number of permits that would cover, you know, a certain amount of gasoline and diesel sold. So if it turns out that you and I drive more, basically what would happen is, and if so, Flint Hills or whoever it might be was selling more gasoline, leading to more greater emissions, they would be responsible for then buying more allowances in order to cover that. So we wouldn't be telling them exactly how much or little gasoline they could sell, but they would be responsible at the end of the period for coming up with allowances to cover their sales.
So essentially raising the price of gasoline, right, so that we're all paid more, essentially.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Yes.
And you have another person at the table, Senator
Madam
Anderson,
Chair.
Ms. Hamilton? Oh, Senator Gimsey.
Long ways over here.
You know that wall that is there, please. Yeah.
I'm trying to get my hands around this whole auction portion of this, and who would receive the proceeds of the initial auction of the units or whatever they may be in this cap and trade?
Yeah, it's a good question. So on the auction, in this case, and I don't know the details of the bill on this, but typically what's done is that in this case, it would probably be the state of Minnesota would get the revenues from selling off the auctions. And then the revenues could be used in a number of different ways. It could be used to help out industries or communities that faced higher energy bills, but they could be used in a number of different ways. The one thing I will like to mention is that those who don't favor auctions say, well, there's a huge cost associated with auctions. You know, we're going to raise a lot, and there may be a lot of revenue that is raised, in fact, from this. The important point to recognize, I think, is that on this, it is revenue raised. It's not that it's a cost to industry and then that money just burns up and vanishes. So it's money that would come from industry for the auction and then would be available for use either going back for energy efficiency projects or however one, on tax relief or however one would wish.
And Madam Chair, just on that point, I just want to point you to some language that's in this amended version of the bill that's on page one that says that recognizes that if you have an auction, it says on line 20, to the extent that allowances are distributed through an auction, the revenue would help consumers and energy-intensive industries pay their energy costs and reduce their energy costs more quickly. And then it goes on, business concerns about paying the cost of allowances must be balanced with benefit to the public. So I think the argument about auctions is that if you sell them, I mean, besides sort of the philosophical reasons about why you should or shouldn't sell them, but if you sell them, then you have the opportunity to rebate the cost to the consumer, so they don't actually pay more for gasoline. But then the industry would be absorbing that additional cost, and they're the ones that would have to figure out ways to reduce emissions. But that you could also direct revenue to helping reduce energy costs at all levels, at industries that are affected, at consumer levels. So the money would be directed towards reducing energy costs, but also reducing energy consumption and leading to those efficiencies more quickly than you might get through just a pure market-based system without auctions.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so once the credits are established and they've been all distributed throughout the industry, I understand there's going to be a trading mechanism for these credits, if you will. Can you explain a little bit about how all of that is going to work?
That's one of the important details, in fact, to work out. I don't know how actually in this, that's one of the details that will have to be worked out in the Midwest Governors Association. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is up and running, and so one can look at the sort of mechanisms that they have in place. The one actually I'm more familiar with, and so let me give this as an example, is the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is a voluntary organization that industries and entities, the University of Minnesota, for example, is a member. This is run through the Chicago Board of Trade. So they, in fact, are the market. They're the people who have the market. So one goes to the Chicago Board of Trade, and you can buy and sell there. The Chicago Board of Trade is the market maker. But again, that's one of the things that one needs to make sure that you have the details right, that there is, in fact, a smoothly functioning market that people can easily buy and sell, and there aren't a lot of transactions costs or difficulties in negotiating it.
Madam Chair, just one final follow-up here. And the reason I ask these questions is because I worked for Enron for 20 years, and 10 years ago, they were talking about a very similar trading scheme, if you will, for this very type of thing. And so I'm a bit skeptical, having gone through the process once with a private company that was going to get involved in this and also seeing the results of that. So I have many, many questions about this, and don't mind me if I'm a bit skeptical of moving forward on this program.
If I can make one comment, I appreciate that, and that's why I've in my comments was saying that there are a lot of details to get right, and we're setting up in a sense a new institutions, and setting up new institutions, if you don't do it right, can run afoul. In cap and trade, there actually is a longer history here. The major cap and trade in the United States goes back to the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments for trading of sulfur dioxide emissions. This market has been going since the mid-1990s. By all accounts, has been going quite well, quite successfully. EPA, U.S. EPA touts it as sort of their model program that they were able to cut sulfur dioxide emissions in half at much lower costs than they had initially expected. So it can be done right, but I agree that you have to pay attention to the details in order to get it right.
And, Madam Chair, I just want to clarify again on in terms of this bill. Just to be clear, Senator Gimsey, this bill does not deal with that at all. This bill does not attempt – I mean, I should say when I first introduced the bill, it actually did try to say not in that level of detail at all, but just in some general terms what the cap and trade, the regional cap and trade, had to have in it. Now, as through the stakeholder process and the compromises that I've made, it doesn't say that anymore. It doesn't say this has to happen. It's really just stepped back and said, here's some principles, ideas. Governor, we'd like you to consider these as you negotiate. But the fact is that this bill doesn't decide any of that, and that the governor is going to decide that. The governor's staff and those four stakeholders, and five other governors are going to set those rules for trading, and that is, you know, the legislative process. I mean, we were trying to sort of weigh in on the front end, got a lot of resistance to that, and I think now what we're trying to do is at least stay informed, offer some advice to the governor at the front end, but in the end, it will be negotiated outside of the state capitol, and we will take a look at it after they put together some kind of a plan, and then it will come back to us for ratification or discussion. I want to be clear. So that's none of that's in my bill.
So, Ms. Hamilton, would you like to address us?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Drake Hamilton. I serve as Science Policy Director for Fresh Energy. I oversee our Global Warming Solutions Program, which is aimed at building a 21st century energy economy for this state around clean, efficient, low-carbon energy. I also was appointed by Governor Pawlenty to serve on the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, as was Dr. Pulaski, and I served on the Cap and Trade Working Group as well as other working groups. Today, in order to streamline our testimony, I'm also testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. The partnership is a coalition of 80 conservation groups and environmental organizations with membership in every district in Minnesota who believe the protection of our waters, our forests, our land and air is at the very core of protecting Minnesota's future. All told, our members number about 500,000 Minnesotans. And each year, the partnership chooses a few issues that rise to the level of being on our priority agenda. And the criteria we have in mind in choosing those priority agenda items are the impact it will have on improving our great outdoors, whether or not there's broad public support, and whether we're in a sweet spot where the state needs to take additional action on an issue. The Green Solutions Act, particularly as it was originally introduced, meets all of those criteria. It's important to keep our mind on the prize here. In the Next Generation Energy Act, the 2007 legislature rightly set science-based goals for reducing across our economy over time our emissions of greenhouse gases and taking our share of responsibility for global warming pollution. But the baseline that the state is working on, the 2005 emissions level as identified by the Pollution Control Agency, is 155 million metric tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, 155 million metric tons. So that's what we need to reduce from. Under business as usual, according to the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group, those emissions, instead of decreasing, would actually increase. We're supposed to get to a reduction of 15% below those levels by 2015 and 30% below those levels by 2025. Instead, we would be increasing by more than 27% by 2025. So we're heading in the wrong direction. The good news is that the Renewable Electricity Standard and the Next Generation Energy Act that this legislature passed with overwhelming support last year helps greatly to reduce the rise in those emissions, to help level things off, particularly in the electricity sector. But there's nothing on the books right now that actually limits greenhouse gas reductions, and the Climate Change Advisory Group identified that the laws that exist today are not nearly enough to get us to the reduction goals set in the Next Generation Energy Act. I think the legislature realized that, and in its instructions to the Climate Change Advisory Group, particularly asked that group, the 56 members, to take a hard look at a regional cap and trade system and how that might benefit Minnesota and help us meet our goals more cheaply than if we did not use market mechanisms. So the Climate Change Advisory Group recommended that the state of Minnesota work with Midwestern Governors Association partners on a multiple sector across the economy regional cap and trade scheme. So the idea is let's use market forces to try to reduce our carbon as cheaply as possible. And we wanted to make that as simple as possible. So now Governor Pawlenty has set out and has enlisted the support of other governors and is working on the elements of a cap and trade program. So that horse is out of the barn and moving down the track. And this is the chance for the legislature to weigh in on the principles that should guide the development of what that market system looks like. The Minnesota Environmental Partnership and Fresh Energy support 100% auction of global warming allowances, with the auction revenues to be used to speed the transition to this lower carbon, clean energy economy that we're all trying to get to. By auctioning the emissions allowances rather than giving them away, we would let the market set the price on allowances, which we think is the right thing to do, instead of relying on government to set some arbitrary price or make them free. The bill should also not allow offsets outside those sectors of the economy that are limited or capped, because that would weaken the legislature's ability to meet the goals that Minnesota set for itself in 2007, and you don't want to undercut your own efforts. So in summary, the environmental and conservation organizations that are a part of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership support the legislature weighing in with the governor as he proceeds with this administrative process to make this market rule as strong as possible to benefit Minnesota's economy with Minnesota's interests in mind. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions in the committee?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Michelle and then Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for Senator Anderson, although if Ms. Hamilton wants to respond, that'd be great. I guess my question is more of process here. So we have six states and a province. Senator Anderson, is your legislation modeled on something that one of the other five states is doing? Do we have six other legislatures now jumping in and trying to tell their governor, here, you might want to do it this way or you might want to do it that way? I'm trying to figure out how many actors are coming to the table on this now.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I honestly don't know. I'm not aware of other states that are doing this.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, as a follow-up to that, you pointed out the language on 312 and 313. So this agreement, if there were to be an agreement, would not become effective until enacted into Minnesota law. Are other states putting that condition on this governor's negotiation? Or I think you're going to say no because your answer to the first question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I really don't know. I haven't heard about what other states are doing. But I also think, I mean, the only other example I can think of that's remotely comparable to this is the Great Lakes Compact or issues like that where there's been a compact agreed to by various governors. And those, of course, all have to be ratified by the states to become effective. And I think that they should be. You know, the question is whether we really don't know. This is all new territory. We don't know, Madam Chair, we don't know if this will be, if an agreement is reached among the governors, whether they will ask the states to ratify it exactly as is or to kind of set it as a floor. Other regions that have done this, the northeastern states were the first. The REGI group was a number of northeastern states that put together a regional cap and trade agreement. And theirs is further along than ours. And in that case, what they did was, and I'm not an expert, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they set a floor for issues like auctions and things like that. They said, here's the minimum that we want to do as a region, and the states are free to do more if they want to. And, okay, they're saying that's right. So I don't know what structure it would be, but, you know, it could go anywhere from that to some extreme where the governors could come back and say, take it or leave it. If you don't adopt every, you know, cross every T and dot every I, then the agreement is null and void. I would hope they wouldn't do that. I just think that we shouldn't cede our legislative voice in this process completely to the governors. And I imagine in all those states that have Democratic governors, you might agree with me as well, the other five states that are part of this agreement. And it's not about being partisan. It's about us being elected to represent our constituents. And, I think something this important obviously has to be enacted into law to become effective. And I would expect that we will have a vigorous debate and discussion about the details at that time. But I also was reluctant to wait and just sort of wait for them to come back with something and look at it then. I thought there needed to be some way for the legislature to weigh in. And as I said, this bill started out as a much more aggressive way of really mandating what the governor could and couldn't do, and it's I backed off from that.
Okay, thank you. You know, I have to say that at this time, we have to hear Senator Bach's bill today in order to get it through all the committees, and we promise the opponents equal time. And we're not going to be able to do that all today. So we're going to move to Senator Bach's bill, Senator Anderson, and we need to get his bill moved.
Madam Chair, can I say something?
And that, yes, and but we do want to give equal time to both sides, and with the time left, there is no way we can do that today and complete the discussion, so we will come back on Wednesday and discuss this.
So, Madam Chair, maybe I can make your job a little easier because I want to propose – well, I had, you know, I went to Senator Rest Committee last week and had sort of an unanticipated problem, which is that now that we've sort of modified the bill and softened it, it talks only about legislative intent, and now we have some concern that that's not really appropriate for a law to pass with just stating legislative intent. So what I am going to propose to this committee, which I think will help shorten the debate that would be necessary about this bill, is to strike Section 2 of the bill, which is the principles. And that's by far the controversial section of the bill. What I intend to do is put those in the form of a resolution, because I actually honestly agree reluctantly with Senator Rest's committee that that's probably more appropriate for this type of language, because it has been sort of softened to the extent that it really just states an opinion. And an opinion that we would like conveyed to other states. And so it really makes more sense for it to be in the form of a resolution. So that will be a separate process. And so really all that would be left of the bill would be the reporting back from the governor's staff, the advisory group of legislators, and then studies about costs and benefits. And I honestly feel that from our stakeholder process, oh, and we would keep the, you know, the sentence that says the legislature would have to enact eventually, if there is a cap and trade, it would have to be enacted by law. It would keep that in place. And I think from all the stakeholder discussions we have, I think that there is very close to a consensus on those items of the bill. I hope I'm right.
And I appreciate that, but we did promise people would have equal time, and we're not going to be able to do that today. So I'm going to...
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure.
Promise you that we will be back on Wednesday to discuss this, and people know about Section 2. That's.
Well, Madam Chair,
if it would
help for a starting point when we come back Wednesday, I'd move to delete Section 2, and then we all know where we're starting on Wednesday.
Okay. Is that a problem, Senator Anderson, with your deadlines getting back on Wednesday?
Yeah, this, Madam Chair, this is the last committee before Finance,
okay. So
it will affect the leadership. Their plan for when they were hoping to see this bill on the floor, it would make that impossible. That's the only thing I wanted you to be aware of.
Okay. Do you want to move your amendment now, Senator Bach? And then
I'll just orally move to delete Section 2.
Okay. Is there discussion?
And then, members, I think if that's Senator Anderson's intent, then when we come back Wednesday, we won't be wasting a bunch of people's time on talking about something that's not in the bill anymore. So if our intent is to take that out, let's just get it out.
That's fine.
We'll start from there Wednesday.
Okay. Is there discussion on Section 2 being deleted on the Bach Amendment?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, just I would then ask, I mean, I think that Senator Anderson would like us to move this out. And if there is no more objection to the bill, because I think what's left is study, although there is an assessment in here. But
we did promise people a chance to talk, and then if we do the Bach bill, it's just
there's more concerns.
And there are some other concerns that we need to hear.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
Okay. So, okay. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails. And thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank
you very much. And we will see you on Wednesday. Senator Bach with Senate File 3291, State Building Code Applications and Enforcement Regulations. So, Senator Bach, if you'd like to begin.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 3291, and I do have an author's amendment. I believe it's the council's at the A1.
Do we have the A1 amendment, please?
And this is the first committee that it's been in. But members, what the A1 does is it makes sure that where we have small little sawmills, that they're allowed to still sell directly to the consumer, to the home builder, material out of small sawmills. Most small sawmills, and we have them all over in rural Minnesota, especially in the north, haven't gone to the cost of getting themselves certified so they have an official stamp to be able to stamp on the wood, which is a requirement of the state building code that all lumber that goes into a construction project be stamped and graded lumber. This would create an exemption for the small mills that sell directly to the consumer. And that's really the guts of the amendment.
So on the author's amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. All right, Senator Bach, if you'd like to go through the bill.
Madam Chair, there's quite a few pages here, but there's not a lot going on. Madam Chair, what the bill would do is require or set the standard of the provisions of the state building code statewide. Currently, there are a lot of communities that haven't adopted the state building code. There's a lot of construction that's substandard, and the homeowners end up ultimately paying the price for that. It doesn't require that all cities enforce the code. It just says that's the standard. And then individual homeowner could be able to spec that the builder would build to the code. That would be the law. Doesn't require municipalities to take enforcement actions or even have an inspector, but I think it just clarifies that we expect homes in the state to be built to the standards of the state building code. And I have with me, and when we exempt cities under 2,500, I have with me Lisa Furnett from the home builders, and I'd like to have her, they're the ones that brought me the bill. I'd like to have them explain why we need to do this.
Thank you, Ms. Furnett, for being here.
Madam Welcome. Chair, members, I'm Lisa Furnett. I represent the Builders Association Minnesota. This is, as Senator Bach said, it's a simple little bill. What it does is it applies the statewide building code as a standard to be built by builders throughout the state. It also encourages municipalities to use joint power authorities to begin to do enforcement and inspectors, enforcement and administration if they'd like to down the line. We've worked with Senator Bach on this issue, and I've had a chance to speak with several of you. But again, it's pretty basic. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to take some.
For Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Bach, I saw an amendment before committee that dealt with the cost that the cities that did not have code might have to deal with. Has anybody talked to you about that as an issue, or is that an issue that we need to have some concern about?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, nobody has came to talk to me about that, but I think some people have had discussions with Ms. Burnett, so she might be able to answer them.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I have talked with everybody who might possibly be involved with this. Again, this does not mandate any enforcement or administration. You'll see on the sheet of paper here that says statewide building codes, all the interested parties that have been working with us on this bill to make sure that everybody's all right with it. The small cities were fine with it. League of Minnesota cities, the townships, the counties. So I think I've covered all my bases. The Department of Labor and Industry. Nobody has come forward to this point to say they've had a problem, just to work things out, and I believe we've done that.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Latz, you had a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Bach, so you're saying the League of Minnesota Cities is in support of this bill, or they're not objecting to this bill, or they just haven't approached you to talk about it?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, nobody has approached me, but I think Ms. Furnett has been dealing with all the stakeholders. She's done a good job keeping them out of my hair. So I guess her testimony on that is more adequate than mine.
Maybe another bill that they
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, the League of Minnesota Cities is not objecting to this bill. As far as I know, they're fine with it. We've worked with them to make sure that the language fit the way they wanted to, especially when there might be fees that might be asserted to the cities, and they're comfortable with the language as it is.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I will contact the League, and this bill has to go to state and local, and if...
Thanks for asking.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe I won't have to contact them. But I certainly, Madam Chair, am not interested in putting an additional burden on our cities. The state hasn't been the best partner with our cities in the last few years, and my intent is not to put some kind of additional mandate on our cities and then especially provide no revenue for them to carry it out.
So, Ms. Wynn, would you like to introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Wayne Wynn with the League of Minnesota Cities. We have worked with Lisa Frenette and the Builders Association, and we are working to address some concerns that we do have in the bill, but we are working together very well. So
you're comfortable?
We are comfortable with the bill, yes.
Very good. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, is this just a floor so that if a city wanted to have more stringent building codes, they could opt to do so?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, what this is a standard, so that this is the standard statewide. I think there's the flexibility for municipalities is the degree of enforcement. It doesn't require that they take enforcement action, doesn't require that they have inspectors. I think the difference in communities is the amount of energy that a particular community might put into the enforcement side of it. But this does set the standard for what home construction should be.
So,
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, if I understand you correctly, then a city would not have the option of raising the standard for its own community and enforcing a higher standard. Is that right?
Madam Chair, I don't believe they have that authority right now. I mean, the code is the code. And once they adopt it, and a lot of cities, I think the metropolitan area has all adopted the code, that, and maybe council can help me, but that sets the standard.
Are there other questions? Without any more questions, Senator Bach, would you like to move this bill as amended to state and local government?
Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 3291 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Very good. Is there further discussion on the Bach on the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.